CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
But I said from the get-go, I said, I want this just to be the biggest vomiting scene in the history of cinema.
Welcome to SinCast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the SinCast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Jonathan Watkins.
Hello, hello.
And Barrett Scher.
Hi.
Today we have a very special guest. It's director Rennie Harlan, who has a movie called The Misfits coming out in theaters June 11th, on demand and digital June 15th. Rennie, welcome.
Thank you very much, Chris. Pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you for coming on, man. I just was watching this. I was watching this, and there's this particular scene in The Misfits where I'm like, man, Rennie Harlan really loves making movies. You love making movies, don't you?
I totally do. I always say, you know, I just finished shooting another movie literally yesterday.
Oh, wow.
And wow. And everybody says to me like, oh, you must be so relieved. It's like, it's done now. Don't you feel great? And I'm like, yeah, in a way. But in a way, it's like, I'm totally sad because what I love doing is making movies. I love being on the set to be completely honest. And this sounds so selfish and self-centered and egotistical and horrible. But I kind of feel like a rock star when I'm on the movie set. I'm like, It's my world and it's like all these people there and I get to tell them what I think they should do and we work together to create this illusion. And it's like being a kid. It's totally like I'm just a kid who never grew up. And every time, every movie, it's the same feeling. And when it ends, I feel empty and I feel it's like a drug. I feel now I'm just sitting here in my living room and like nobody cares. And just yesterday there were like 400 people around me whose every move depended on what I wanted to do. So I love
Rennie, you can tell us what to do. It's fine. Just order us around for the next 30 minutes or so.
Absolutely.
I say this mainly just because there's a scene in here where there's a bunch of prisoners vomiting. And I was sitting there going, okay, you could make this scene where like you see a few people vomiting and you're like, all right, that's the prison's got something going on.
Yeah.
But what you do here is no, you're going to have an overhead shot of the stalls and you're going to have the camera move over the stalls. You're going to have a crane come down from like level 3 to 2 to 1 and everything like that. I mean, you shoot that scene like it's the biggest joy of your life to show people vomiting on screen. And I appreciate that.
You know, I love making comedies. I don't get to do that a lot because I'm known more like a sort of a hardcore action or horror guy or something. But I love comedy. And to me, it's certain scenes when you're doing comedy, it's like you either go all the way or you don't go. And so it's certainly in the script, it wasn't at all on the kind of epic scale that it ended up in the movie. But I said from the get-go, I said, I want this just to be the biggest vomiting scene in the history of cinema. And so we built that bathroom just so that I could do a shot where I'm like moving over the stalls and showing everybody throwing up. Actually, it was one of the days, one of the very few days when I was really upset with the producers when we shot the exterior scene outside the prison, where, like you said, you go from tier 3 to 2 to 1 and everybody is vomiting, because they had saved money and somebody had just in their wisdom decided that we had like enough vomit made for like 6 people for like 3 takes. So, because, you know, if you're doing an epic vomiting scene from different angles and you want like 100 people to be vomiting, you need like at least 100 gallons of vomit.
Oh my God.
So I was just like, what are you talking about? You have only like eight, you know, like whatever it was. We had like maybe like 3 gallons of vomit. I'm like, this is ridiculous. It's like, I want everybody to be vomiting and I want to do several takes of it. So we literally had to like find a guy who started making vomit on the spot. And it's a real science, you know, how you make good looking vomit. So it wasn't easy.
You never know what I mean. I was sitting there. I watched The Long Kiss Goodnight recently, and there's that scene at the end where there's like cars exploding all over the truck mm-hmm. explodes yeah. and the cars are flying all over the place and everything. And I'm like, you put as much zeal into this vomiting scene as you did into that explosion scene in The Long Kiss Goodnight.
Yeah.
And so yeah, it's amazing. I was wondering what drew you to this project in the first place.
A friend of mine, the producer, Kia Cham, he had the script. He sent it to me. He said, I have this fun project. You should read it. And I trusted his taste. I read it, and I was hooked immediately. I felt like, okay, at least one person on this earth knows that I love comedy and I love telling funny stories. And just felt like it was a different kind of a movie for me. I like anybody, I love heist movies, and I like, you know, mm-hmm. entertaining movies where you go to the theater and I feel like people watch movies for various reasons, but one main thing is that you want to feel something. You want to be you want to laugh, or you want to be scared, or you want to be emotionally moved. And escape from your life for a couple of hours. And in this case, it was a heist movie and a caper and a fun movie where you get to laugh and just be entertained. And I felt like this is the kind of movie I would love to watch and I would love mm-hmm. to make.
And a really unique heist movie too, because you've got it's almost like the Robin Hood of heist movies, right?
Yes, that was an aspect that I really found. Fascinating and important about the whole movie is that it's not just like some selfish guys who just want to rob money and get rich, but it's actually people who are doing it for a good cause. So, you know, I'm not saying that every movie should be like teaching us a lesson, but if it can have a kind of a positive twist to it, I really like it. And that to me made it really good that, you know, they are criminals. They are doing, you know, things that are not supported by the law necessarily, but they are doing it for a really good reason.
Yeah, it seems like you mentioned having fun. Did you guys have as much fun filming this as what comes across on the screen? Because Pierce Brosnan looks like he's having the time of his life. Nick Cannon is just let loose. Mm-hmm. Hermione Corfield and Jamie Chung. What was the set like? Did you guys have kind of this? Elan and joy and stuff like that, that you see on the screen?
Definitely. And I wanted to, the whole idea that this place takes place in Middle East, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, that world, I decided that I want to create a fantasy world that you wish existed somewhere, where taxis are Lamborghinis and people's pets are cheetahs and stuff like that. So it unfortunately, it doesn't exist. So all those who have now decided to go to Abu Dhabi or Dubai or somewhere there because they want to see this fantasy world, it is pretty glossy there, but it's nothing like the movie. But I really wanted to make it into something amazing. And so everybody had that same spirit. So yes, I would say that the crew was having fun. The actors were having fun. And with comedic stuff, it's the really fun thing is that, you know, the sky is the limit, and you sort of spend your days trying to come up with additional things for the scenes. You have a scene as written, and then you can kind of play with things with the actors and say like, okay, what could we add to this? What could you do, or how could you react, or what else could you say that would be even funnier? And it also applies to camera. I think that in any kind of storytelling, camera is a very important part of it, and especially in comedy, because the way you use the camera, the way you move it, the angles you use, the lenses you use will really help the actors and the story to add to the fun of it. So, yeah, we had a lot of fun shooting.
What was that casting like? I know that Pierce Brosnan's a producer on this, so he may have already been attached to this before.
No. No, Pierce was not attached. I've over the years, I've spoken in several occasions with Pierce about working together, and it never materialized until this. And when I read this, I immediately felt like Pierce is the guy, and I sent him the script, and he loved it, and that's how we then decided to do it together. So as we know, every movie needs that engine. Every movie is like a train that doesn't go anywhere without the engine pulling it, and it means you need somebody well known to get the final and all that together. So Pierce was the engine for sure, but also he was the right guy for this. He was the perfect guy for the part. And then for the other characters, I just wanted to have a really kind of an international, interesting mix of people that would make it feel fresh and fun and not expected. So we just really tried to be inventive the way we put it together.
Yeah, if you told me Pierce Brosnan in real life was an international thief, I would absolutely 100% believe you.
Absolutely.
I think he actually is.
It's a side job. Well, it's nice to see him get back into this Thomas Crown affair, you know, almost like a playful Bondy type of thing. Seems like it's a return to form, and like I said, it looks like he's having a blast.
No, he was having a blast, and he loves to play that kind of a rogue, and it fits him so well. He has a great sense of humor. He's a very, besides being a talented actor, he's a very charming guy and a very sweet, warm guy. So it's just very natural for him to play that. And oh man, it was amazing to see just like anywhere we went, like women practically fell down when they saw him. Because
I think I would too.
He has such an aura, such an aura about himself. I don't know how you even like live being somebody like that, because anywhere you go, people are just like staring at you like you're an apparition. So how do you have to have somebody like reminding you every day, like, hey, you're just human, you're just a normal guy, you're just a normal person, because I think it takes some character to be so humble and normal when you are that kind of an idol. And another person I would say that same kind of a thing about is Jackie Chan, who I made a movie with, and who in China is regarded like literally like he's like God. So, and he's the most humble guy, and he's most sort of helpful and sweet guy to everybody around. It doesn't matter if you're the guy sweeping the floor or if you own the studio. He's nice to everybody and considerate to everybody. So that to me takes real character. And those actors who become stars, who don't have that kind of character, then that kind of fame and stardom really brings the worst out of you, because then you take it as a sort of like you have all the privileges in the world, and you don't have to care about anything or anybody. And I've seen those people too.
Imagine. So I mean, you've been making movies for what now, 35 40 years?
Yeah, I started making movies when I was 3 years old. It's weird.
Oh my God. Isn't that weird? Yeah. That's so strange.
Yeah, I was a child miracle.
Yeah, yeah. How would you say you've changed as a filmmaker over the years? Are you just basically the same guy as you were in the 80s?
I think I'm the same guy. Of course, you learn from everything you do, and you learn to avoid certain mistakes and you can anticipate certain things, how they're going to go and not go. But I'm the same guy that I feel like I'm the same guy that I was when I was a kid, when I fell in love with movies. My mom was an avid movie fanatic, movie goer, and I was her date because my dad was a doctor and always busy working. So I went to the movies. I was like 5 years old with my mom all the time and just fell in love with movies and telling stories, and I was, you know, drawing my own comic books and writing my own stories and drawing my own on things and making little films with our family camera since I was a kid. So so it's just the framework has gotten bigger, but like I'm still the same guy who loves blowing up shit and we were just literally our last night of shooting, like a day ago, was we were doing in this new movie that I'm doing now, we were doing this Afghanistan war scene, and so I have like 20 people running with machine guns and explosions going off and helicopters and things and I'm just like, hey, now I'm really in my element. I realize, what do I love to do? I love blowing up shit and shooting guns. And it's basically, I'm the same guy that I was when I was 8 years old and doing that, you know, with my friends. And now I'm just doing it in a different framework. And I loved doing that when I did my first movie. And I love it just as much now that I did my 30th movie.
What's the most thrilling thing about blowing shit up? Is it the actual filming of it, or is it getting into the editing room and seeing it all come together and making the sound real loud and, you know, and all that? Where do you get your most enjoyment out of it?
I get most enjoyment from being on the set and being also in like really hard conditions, whether it's snow or heat or sand or wind. Of being like being in the environment, and you know, not necessarily on a sound stage, but like outdoors in a really rough situation where you have to like battle to get it done, and of course it's then you also when you're editing and you see it come together and with the sound and the music and everything, but when we're shooting this Afghanistan scene just the other night. Everything is there and it's this huge scene and it's lit beautifully and the wind is blowing and these red torches are going off and the whole it really actually reminded me of like one of my favorite movies, Apocalypse Now, how it looked and felt. And so I blasted. I always play music for the crew and for the cast to inspire them and to get them to the right mood. So I was playing the Ride of the Valkyries from the opera. But blasting that music, we are in this giant quarry. I'm blasting the music in the middle of the night, and I'm just looking at this scene in front of me, and I'm saying, like, who gets to do this stuff? Who gets to have this much fun?
What's different now about making movies than it was back in the day? What challenges do you have to deal with that you didn't have to back then, or is it easier? I asked this question. We had George Gallo on here at one point asking him about this, but we don't get a chance to talk to somebody who's had a career that spanned for this long. So I was just always interested to know what it's like making movies today as compared to the past.
It's a complex question because in a certain way it's gotten easier because of the whole digital revolution, which makes basically anything possible now. But you know, if somebody can write it, then you know, we can make it happen. And in a certain way, to me, it's a loss because there's something about the movies of the 90s or you know, that era when I started, when things were done for real and it had to be done either with actors or with stunt guys. But now, you know, all the big movies, action movies or comic book movies, they are like huge sequences are completely animated. I think the audience sees it, but sometimes the audience doesn't realize it, that they're watching an animated movie. Even, you know, a car chase might be completely digitally created and then digi-doubles for people. You know, they instead of stunt guys or actors, you know, people are flying around and slamming into things and it's all digital. Or now any big movie, they immediately, first thing they do when they start, they scan the actors. And then they have a perfect scan of the actors, and then whenever they want, they can just use a digital version of the actor. Wow. Maybe not in a facial close-up, but anything else can be digital. So to it, it, of course, it's an advantage to a certain point in a certain way, but to me, in another way, it's a loss. And I think the audience also senses it. And I get quite often, I get comments from people saying like either that they miss those movies that we used to make in the 90s. They miss the, you know, feeling and seeing the real thing. And mm-hmm. that people would like to see that more. But I don't know, you know, whether the studios will ever go back, or there's any reason to go back. I don't know. But I do see that big change, and I like when it comes to the Misfits, for example. There's almost zero digital shots in the movie, so it is a throwback in itself to that style of filmmaking.
The cheetah is real.
Yes, it is.
Wow. I do have, Randy, I have a burning question for you.
Okay.
Because I like I said, we've all adored your movies over the years. But when I think about your movies, I think about Die Hard 2, Cliffhanger, Long Kiss Goodnight, things like that. There's always, and especially Deep Blue Sea, there's always one, there's like a splash page in a comic book. There's one scene that immediately comes to mind for each of these films. Same thing with even Skip Trace, the Rolling in the Deep scene, and the and the Misfits, of course, the vomit scene. Do you go into your projects kind of thinking like this is going to be my splash page, or is it more of like working up to it and being like, oh yeah, this is kind of like the centerpiece of the film?
Really good question, and I would say I do go into a movie thinking like, what is the kind of key image that this movie will be remembered for, and I call it a trailer moment. What is the and of course there are, hopefully in every movie there are lots of trailer moments, but I do think of that, and then of course partially it just develops organically when you're making the movie. You realize what just turns out to be really epic. I always try to do something really big, you know, big shots. Me a good movie has to have those big moments, big shots. And also actually, you know, one thing that sometimes bothers me of today's movies, even action movies, is like a lot of stuff is shot very tight and cut so fast that in a fight, you don't really see what's happening. You're not clear about the geography and even the, like, almost like the sound is telling you what's happening more than what you're seeing. So it's a funny thing. I don't know why, but I do try to think of those things beforehand, and I do have in mind what's going to be the big thing, and then sometimes I surprise myself. Sometimes what I thought was going to be the big thing, it's not necessarily such a big thing, but then something else pops up.
That's interesting.
But like in Cliffhanger, for example, the opening scene with the girl falling, that was very intentional.
Yeah.
I didn't want to hire Sylvester Stallone to play the part. I wanted somebody like Harrison Ford. I wanted the movie to feel very real. And to me, Stallone was so much bigger than life because of Rambo that it just wasn't, to me, didn't feel like the right thing. So I created that scene just because the studio wanted me to cast him. I said, well, then I have to like strip him out of his superpowers right in the opening scene. So that scene was completely created by me to make him, to humanize him.
Wow.
Oh, that's great.
That's so awesome.
Cause that scene is that movie. That's a big reason why that movie works. Oh, that's amazing.
And in the same way, in Deep Blue Sea, there was no Sam Jackson's character didn't exist in the script at all, but I had done The Long Kiss Goodnight, and we had kind of sworn friendship, and that we'll always work together. So I was afraid of telling him that I'm doing this big movie with Warners, but there's no part for you. So I racked my brain, and I came up with the idea that okay, the movie seems like it's starring Sam Jackson, and then he's just killed right in the middle of the movie, and I. kind of stole that idea from the first Alien, where Tom Skerritt is the captain of the ship, and there's like nobody famous in the movie, and nobody kind of knew who Sigourney Weaver was. And last thing you would think is that she's going to be the lead. And just when you thought, like, well, at least there's Tom Skerritt and he's going to save them, then he gets killed. So I stole that idea from there, and we added Sam's character into the script. And yes, all the time in that movie, I knew that's going to be the moment in the movie. And when it sure is. And it was really like scientific how we designed his speech, so that it's long enough that you start thinking like, oh, this is one of these hero speeches, come on. But short enough that you don't, you know, go and get more popcorn or something. So it had to be, it was like telling a joke. It just had to be exactly the right length for it to work and deliver.
That scene is one of the most surprising moments I've ever had watching a movie. Most of the time, whenever there is somebody about to die, I don't know what the deal is, but directors always seem to frame it in such a way where you're just like, okay, I know something's going to happen to this person. Yeah. In this one, that I never got that sense. It may just be because it's Samuel L. Jackson on screen, and you're like, there's no way this guy's going to just automatically die in this movie and everything. But you are absolutely right. That is how you tell a joke with an incredible punchline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because he's just in the middle of a line when he gets, and you're just not expecting it whatsoever. It's one of the best. It's one of my favorite scenes in a movie ever, just because of the way that was done and everything.
I've always pictured the shark was waiting too, like he was actually listening to the speech, and then at some point it's like, okay, this is enough.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm done.
Absolutely. And you know, we had a huge debate with Warner Brothers whether we should put that moment, or whether they should put that moment in the trailer or not. And there were those who said, like, it's such a great moment, you got to have it in the trailer. And to this day, I don't know what was the right decision, because it's not in the trailer. And would the movie had made another 100 million if it was in the trailer? Maybe. Or would people have been totally disappointed because they already saw that coming, so then there's no surprise. I don't know what the right answer is, and we will never know.
That's fascinating. It's just all the little decisions that go into making a film that you never know about, you know? I mean, you watch a film, you're like, all right, that's the decision that the director took, or the direction. But you have to make every little tiny decision, and sometimes it turns into a big one, like casting Sam Jackson and creating that whole character, and therefore creating the iconic moment of that film.
And yeah, and you actually you hit the nail on the head right by what you said, because you know, sometimes people can think that directors are egomaniacs and like, okay, everything has to be just so the way you want it. It's like, I said yellow flowers and you brought white flowers. I can't choose. But it is director's job is to, like, the movie is made out of thousands and thousands of decisions. And as a director, you either care about every decision or you care about nothing. You can't categorize like, here are important things and here are not so important things. Of course, you have to be a little bit flexible and you have to be reasonable if you're, you know, standing in the middle of the desert and all you have is yellow flowers and you wanted white flowers, you got to make it work. But it is, directing is it's a funny thing, like such little things that, you know, a normal person would be like, who cares if he's wearing slippers or flip-flops, or who cares if he has a watch that has a black band instead of a brown band, or who cares if, you know, he does it to the left or instead of right. But you have to care. As a director, that's your job, and you have to care, and everything has to be. And it is kind of crazy, you know, if I think, like, I look at my phone now where everything is like done on WhatsApp, and like the wardrobe people, for example, there's like some extra in some scene in a wedding who is like standing in the background eating pizza. And the wardrobe people send me photo after photo after photo of different outfits for this person. I'm said like, no, I think the shirt should be different. And no, I don't like those pants. And like, I look at now my phone and there's just like these chains of these conversations with different departments about different things. And you either care or you don't. And then if you don't care about thousands of things, then when it all comes together, it's not going to be good. or at least it's not going to be what you wanted it to be. And so you have to be particular, even when it sometimes seems, for a normal person, it seems ridiculous.
Like, if you need a lot of vomit, you got to get a lot of vomit.
Yes.
Yeah, man.
And it has to be a certain kind of consistency and certain color.
Well, it looks like we're going to have to cut this off, unfortunately. This is we're right at the 30-minute mark. And But I could talk to you forever, man. Well, you probably have a million other stories.
I do have lots of stories. I have lots of stories. So
Hey, Rennie, can I tell you one quick thing, though, before we go? I wanted to share this with you. I've been podcasting for about 4 years, and I've always done that when I get introduced, I do the double hello, the hello, hello. That actually stemmed from Robert Englund's performance in Ford Fairlane.
Oh, That's funny.
I've always wanted to tell that to you and Robert. I haven't met Robert yet, but
awesome. That's so great cool. to hear. Great to hear.
Well, we'll have to do this again when the next film comes.
Definitely. I really enjoyed talking to you, and you know, it's just, you know, I can just hear from you guys that you love movies, and you seem to also know my movies embarrassingly well. So I feel totally self-conscious, but I would be lying if I, you know, I'm smiling here ear to ear, and it feels good when people give a shit.
That's right.
Just before we sign off, what's the name of your movie you just got done shooting?
Refuge. It's a
Refuge.
Okay. Refuge, and it's a thriller. It's a really good script. It's a thriller about a young American soldier who goes to fight in Afghanistan and gets, everybody thinks he got PTSD, but he's actually possessed by a demon who lived in those ancient lands.
Awesome.
Wow.
And then horrible things start happening.
Oh.
All right. Well, I'm going to be on the lookout for that one as
well. We'll talk about that probably later on this year.
That'll be great. The movie's The Misfits. It comes out in theaters June 11th, on demand and digital June 15th. We'd like to thank Rennie Harlan for giving us his time. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, guys. It was such a pleasure. I wish you all the love and happiness and luck in the world.
Oh, my God. Just clear your schedule. Can we just talk to you for the rest of the day?
Yeah.
And we can, like,
I would love
you to. Know.
Let's have beers together.
Sounds good. That's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkins and Jonathan Watkins and Barrett Sher. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.